Welcome to another edition of Cloud Unfiltered. I'm Michael Chenitz, and this is actually a special edition at KubeCon. I keep forgetting to mention that in all the previous videos, but this is a special edition at KubeCon. We are recording live from KubeCon, and I have
Dayan.
I still messed it up no matter what, and I tell everybody this. I'm so bad at like any kind of names. Forget it. That's it. So, yes, but from CERN, which is one of my favorite institutes because I am a science nut. And that is just, you know, the fact that you work there, that's amazing to me.
Thank you.
So, you know, the way that this came about is I reached out to you because I saw you doing some really cool things at CERN. And so I just wanted to kind of have a conversation of like, what goes on and how did this come about? How do you even start working at CERN? Like,
well, there are different ways to get to CERN. CERN has different open positions. So there are positions for students, there are positions for junior engineers, then there are for staff and more senior engineers. And I came as a student, and then I got another position as a junior software developer. So then I just continued my stay at CERN. So basically just through an online application, and then everything started.
So wait a minute. I could work at CERN if I wanted to?
Yes, if you're qualified, absolutely. Yes. Yeah.
That's a big if there, so we'll see. But
No. Depends if there are projects that match your skill. Your skills. That's a big if as well.
That's
so
cool.
It's not only if you have enough skills, but if your skills can be applied in a specific place and at a specific time. So, for example, for my current position, I was very lucky to have experience with machine learning and with containers before I applied.
Yeah.
And at that time when I applied, there was a position that required machine learning and containers knowledge. So it was just...
That was a perfect fit.
Exactly. Sometimes it's just good timing and sometimes it's bad timing. And then
That's awesome. So what came first? Was it the machine learning or was it containers? What did you start out doing?
I did containers initially.
Really?
Yeah, that was a task at work back when I had an internship in the US. So I got to learn Docker.
Yeah.
And machine learning I did on my own time because I was curious and interested and I really loved the prospect of it, the idea. So I did some projects on my own and then had an internship at CERN that was basically training a lot of models in particle reconstruction where I got to like practice the machine learning in a professional environment.
You make it sound so easy. I just created some models and, you know, and this is just like, it's like anybody can do it, you know, and that's what makes it sound like. But it's really, you know, there's a lot that goes in. I mean, training is the most, you know, one of the most important things.
Yes.
That occurs. So what did you have to do? Like, what did you have to start to learn to understand how to train those?
Well, basically the theory of machine learning.
Yeah.
And then go through some courses on Python, on TensorFlow, PyTorch, just to understand the machine learning frameworks and how you can put that knowledge into practice and how you can actually train the neural networks. Because with so many different frameworks nowadays, it's not that difficult to create a neural network and to actually train it. And you don't have to be an expert in even mathematics to be able to run basic neural networks.
Yeah, and that's the thing for me is, you know, that's what scares me away because I'm super good at computers and anything that's cloud and anything that's, you know, at least I consider myself. Maybe people don't consider me good at it. I think I'm good at it. And, you know, but when it comes to math, that's where I fall down. So I'm always concerned that math is what's going to...
So that's the reason why I moved to machine learning infrastructure. That's why I moved away from the research. Yeah, the math is really complex and difficult, and the research has really gone far that you really have to be very good at it to be able to improve the existing models. But luckily, there are many different ways to work in AI without actually developing the models. There are still big challenges in AI infrastructure, such as training the models, scaling the model training, supporting multiple users. And this is what I currently work on at CERN.
But you guys didn't just work on it. I mean, you guys now created your own kind of platform, right?
We are using the open source platform, the existing one. It's called Kubeflow.
Yeah.
It originated by Google in 2018, I think. Maybe it was even before. I'm not sure. It's an open source platform that basically you can just take the code from GitHub and deploy it to your own servers. And you can deploy it to GCP, to Azure, to AWS, or you can do it on your private cloud as well. So what we do, we have a private cloud. We have an OpenStack that's supporting that cloud. And we just create a bunch of virtual machines that serve as Kubernetes nodes. And then we deploy our Kubeflow application on top of that. And then we support the users through the UI and make sure everything works as expected.
So in terms of the amount of users, I'm sure there's a ton of users on that platform though.
Actually, it depends how many GPUs we have. In the end of the day, it scales according to the number of GPUs because we can have the best platform in the world. If we don't have GPUs, nobody's going to train the models on the CPUs. Yeah. So in that regard, we scale according to the number of our GPUs, according to our resources, but it's been very well accepted at CERN. And it's a new technology, and it allows to go beyond the training models on your local GPU, which is a current major challenge, I would say, at CERN in terms of infrastructure. So this platform allows you to train models on multiple GPUs to get them on demand and to basically release a GPU once your training job is complete. Compared to, for example, if you take a Jupyter notebook and you take a GPU, then it's there until your notebook is there.
Yeah.
So this platform really helps with scalability. And in addition to being able to scale our workloads on our private cloud, on our on-premise cluster, we can also scale to public cloud as well.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, that's quite amazing. We do GitOps with Argo CD, for example. Basically, the entire installation of our Kubeflow instance is in our GitLab repo. So we just deploy that installation to different cloud providers, depending whether we have resources on these providers.
And can you split the tasks between on-prem and in the cloud and do things like that?
We haven't tried that yet, no. But I think it would be possible. It should be possible.
That would be pretty cool, to be able to scale. And to be able to auto-scale those tasks would be pretty neat, too, by deciding, hey, we need to be more cost-efficient, and we maybe this is a low-priority type thing that we can do on-prem, or something that needs to be, scaled to the cloud and take up more just because we need this information faster and we need it to...
That's the idea. We'll try to do that. We'll see how our workloads scale. But that's the idea.
So in terms of implementing this, have you guys created, it sounds like with GitOps, you've kind of created your own platform to implement this and kind of scale it out, distribute it?
In terms of GitOps, we're using the existing Argo CD platform.
Oh, you are?
Yes. So it's, again, an open source project.
Yeah, sure.
And we just leverage that to distribute our workloads. So we did not implement it ourselves.
Yeah,
we are basically end users of these technologies.
Cool.
But for the Kubeflow itself, we are using this open source manifests to deploy it, to install it, but we have to do a lot of customizations. And that's the main part of work, because in theory, it should work. But in practice, there are so many customizations that we have to do. And there's a file with a list of all components that we deploy by default. And then there's a separate folder structure with our customizations. And one by one, the items on this list, I just comment it out and just move it to this folder structure where I do the customizations. So it's a lot of work there, but it's still doable, and it's maintainable, and it's deployable, and it runs in production, which is quite amazing for us. So,
Yeah, I mean, is there ways to automate that in terms of, maybe through Crossplane or through Terraform or through something that will... just pick those values for you so you don't have to do it every time? Or is there something different every time?
That's a good question. Yeah, with the upgrades, we have to always do different customizations because there were components that worked in this version. Then in the next version, they don't work. And then we have to always be careful. So
the joys of open source.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Yeah, that tends to happen. I mean, it's funny as I can relate because anytime I install something that's open source, typically you get it working a certain way, something gets changed, and then you have to re-implement that, and usually the config file is in YAML or something else, and you have to, you know, whatever setting has changed, you know, you're trying to, it's almost trial and error to figure out some of those settings, yes. You know, especially the tweaks to CPU and hardware and you know, and exactly. How many threads and, you know, all the kinds of tuning and things like that.
Yes, yes, yes.
And that's the most important, I would think, for what you guys are doing.
Yeah, yeah, it's difficult. Yeah, many things can go wrong. But yeah, we're getting better at debugging and understanding what can go wrong. So, yeah.
And how big's the group of people that you guys that are?
It's
that are...
me and my supervisor, Ricardo. So it's four of us.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's not full-time on this project. So, yeah.
And in terms of, so this is, as you're using Kubeflow, so it's all in Kubernetes. And you said it's mostly on-prem. You're kind of messing around with the cloud provider. Are there a lot of Kubernetes type tweaks that you have to make to make this run, you know, in Kubernetes per se? You know?
Yes, exactly. Yes. For example, we introduced resource quotas in our latest release. So yeah. We are for every profile, we are giving us a default resource quota. And for example, we will try not to have any GPUs in the default quota, and then we will negotiate with users availability of GPUs for every user. Then we will give some quota on memory and on CPUs, and then this is automatically managed. So that's quite amazing about Kubernetes, that there are so many little things that can make your life so much easier.
Yeah, we actually just bought a company called Opsani that does, like, it'll look at your Kubernetes application and adjust it so that all those values, figure out what those values are optimal for you. But I would imagine something like machine learning that wouldn't be beneficial, because you're always changing what it's going to do. So
yes.
You can't really optimize for it because it's going to change all
exactly.
the time.
Exactly, yes, yes. Yes, that's why we have to monitor the instance all the time, and we are in close contact with our users. We have a channel of communication where they can write, and then they can ask questions, and we help them out. And as you said, like, things are changing constantly, and we have to be careful all the time.
Do you guys have like a dashboard that you can see how things are running, or see if something's, like, you know, using not enough GPUs, or give it more, allocate things?
Well,
or?
We do some monitoring with Grafana, yes.
With Grafana?
Yes.
Yeah, that's cool. And you guys, obviously, Grafana, you can set up any way you want. So
yes. It's very nice. Yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. What kind of things are they doing? What kind of things are you running on these kind of AI stacks? Or can you talk about that?
Yes, that's, of course. Yeah. that's the topic of our talk tomorrow. So that will be interesting.
Yeah.
There's a wide range of applications of machine learning at CERN. Because the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, is colliding the beams of protons, and then these collisions produce a lot of data. And we're talking about 40 million collisions per second.
Wow.
And then that translates to around 90 petabytes of data per year by all experiments. So that's a lot. So that itself gives you a lot of potential for application of machine learning in different stages, and obtaining some results in different ways. So we can apply machine learning in data acquisition, like while we propagate these events from the detectors to the storage system, or mm-hmm. we can apply it in the offline analysis to actually get some physics results. So one example that is currently being heavily researched at CERN is the application of machine learning in the trigger systems. And the trigger systems are basically making a selection for each and every of those 40 million collisions. They're deciding whether to store this particular event, this particular collision, or to throw it away, because there's no computing infrastructure that can support 40 million collisions per second. So you have to make a decision to select events which you think are interesting in terms of physics. So you have to go to around 1,000 events that you consider interesting. So these trigger systems, they already use some boosted decision trees, for example, in machine learning, but now there's a research to apply deep learning methods that early in the trigger and to make a good selection of events. And now there are major challenges. First one being training the models to have good performance, and the second, deploying these models to the FPGAs and having a fast inference. So yeah, that's one example. Another example is in simulations. Traditionally, we're using some Monte Carlo simulations that take a lot of time, that are state-of-the-art in terms of physics, but take a lot of time. And there are alternatives like 3D guns that are being researched as a faster way to do these simulations. And then these models are very computationally intensive to train. So those are some examples of machine learning, and also the facilities themselves, such as the LHC, the experiments, the cloud infrastructure, that produces a lot of data. So we use machine learning to do some anomaly detection, to proactively monitor the systems and make sure everything is in peak performance.
So yeah, there's so many questions I have from all this that you just said. One is, you know, I've played around with FPGAs. I know that they take a bit of time to program, usually when you're programming them. Yes. So how many FPGAs are we talking about to program?
To be honest, I don't know the number of the FPGAs.
But it's a lot or like a few?
I think it's, honestly, I wouldn't know the exact number. I would say a lot, but now that's an interesting topic, because now to program these FPGAs, the idea is that you don't program the neural network in VHDL or Verilog or something like that, but rather to use compilers that take your Python developed model and then just compile it for the FPGA, and then that runs for inference. So there is even a certain in-house compiler. It's called HLS4ML, which basically you train your model, you push it through this compiler, and then you can run it on the FPGA to get your fast inference.
Wow. And the other thing I was thinking about is, how much data do you actually, I mean, you can't just put it on a USB drive, so what do you do with that data after you have all that data and then you want to run something else?
I mean, you mean where the data is stored?
Yeah, where it's stored.
I think in the end it goes to tapes. Store it for long-term storage.
Because, because you're saying it's petabytes.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so potentially each thing you run is going to be petabytes. So you're running a lot of data.
Yes, yeah. Initially, people first validate with some subsets of data sets. But yeah, for some bad jobs, probably it's like, hundreds of gigabytes to train some models, yeah.
Wow.
So we are working towards being able to support that kind of use cases with our platform. We at the moment don't have GPUs to be able to run that kind of workloads, but at some point we had access to 128 GPUs on GCP, and we were able to run our analysis on that many GPUs. So that was amazing, and it literally scaled in a linear way. So we got from training a model one epoch for 1 hour with one GPU to training it for 30 seconds with 128 GPUs.
It sounds like you guys need like a sponsorship from NVIDIA or something like that. You know, that would be nice.
Yes.
Maybe NVIDIA, if you're listening, you guys should really sponsor CERN. I mean, that's amazing. So the only other question I was thinking about is, what makes something, and this is totally not related to cloud or anything, but just my interest here. What makes something good or bad when you're actually, you know, looking at those triggers? You know, once you trigger something, you said you're going to throw something away.
Yeah.
Like, what is it? Is it like it has to be within a certain range, or it has to be in a?
Honestly, I would love to be able to answer that question, but honestly, I don't know. That would be something that physicists would probably be able
answer. I'm really curious about that. But you know, I would think that, you know, just thinking about the nature of data, that they're looking at certain ranges and seeing if something. But then you come into, if you're throwing away some data, then is some data, you know, really important that you threw away?
That's a question that's also being researched, and like whether these trigger systems are actually doing what they're supposed to do.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, that's super interesting. So in terms of, you know, we talked a little bit about AIML, we talked about Kubernetes. How do you, you know, you said you used GitOps. Is it a big distributed system? You know, do you have lots of distributed systems that you're using in order to get that you're running all these things on locally?
Actually, for our system, it's basically a cluster provided by OpenStack.
Cool.
So a couple of virtual machines that serve as nodes, and we just deploy our Kubeflow instance there. It's not distributed in a sense that we run on different regions in. In Europe or something like that. Everything is, like, the servers are in Switzerland, in CERN.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
So what's your favorite part of working at CERN?
there are multiple things that are quite amazing. Working at CERN, for example, this fact that you work in a research organization that does this fundamental research for humanity and that hopefully will get us closer to understanding the origins of the universe and how the particles interact and being able to know all that, it's quite amazing. So there's never a question of purpose in work. So yeah. That's quite amazing. And also the people you meet, the conversations you have, the technology you work on, it's amazing. And like even these opportunities that we have to come to KubeCon, to present, to do a podcast, it's amazing. So those are my favorite things, I would say, but there are many, many more.
Yeah, I'm absolutely sure. I mean, I've mentioned to you how I want to go to CERN so bad. Like,
to see
what that's, it has to be amazing to be there and just to be able to see that collider and everything.
Yes, 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 yes. At the moment, their test beams and the LHC will run again full steam soon. So that means there will be no visits to underground for a while, but then there will be a shutdown, and that is the moment where the visitors come and can actually go down in the caverns and see the experiments, the LHC.
I have a media badge. Does that get me into to see the actual collision? No?
I don't think so.
Oh, well. Well, so the last question that I ask everybody here, since we're at KubeCon, is what are you interested in seeing here? Like, what have you, I know you've been here for only a little bit right now, but have you seen anything? Is there stuff that you're interested in seeing that you're...
Yes, mostly I'm interested in Kubeflow talks, because this is something that can benefit us, and we want to see how other people are using it and deploying it, and what kind of problems they're solving, and how do they manage their instances and what are the challenges they have. So for me, that's the major that's the major interest. That's what I'm interested about. Maybe interesting machine learning applications that don't necessarily run on Kubeflow but on other platforms, so that we can see what we can integrate into our platform and how we can make things better for our users. So that kind of things.
That's really cool. So where can people reach you if they want to like see what you're doing? Are you online? Do you have somewhere that somebody can, you know, are you on Twitter or anything like that?
Actually, LinkedIn is the best way, as you did. So yes, I think that's the best way to do it.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming. This has been amazing. I mean, I'm so amazed at what you do there, and so amazed at what everybody does there. It's just, you know, for me, this is one of my most exciting talks.
Thank you very much, Michael. It's been amazing to be here.
Well, thanks again. All right.